You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the combined July-August 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. This issue features Kate Middleton on the cover. Now here's the editor's letter from Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief, with photograph by Mark Seliger. At the height of the conspiracy theories about Kate Middleton's whereabouts after a planned surgery, as rumors swirled about body doubles, deep fakes, and other deceptive tactics of the disinformation age, it struck me that the British monarchy was, again, ironically, proving its resilience. Outside of world leaders and Taylor Swift, more on her shortly, who but the future Queen of England could generate such attention, such interest, such unhinged speculation? The truth turned out to be humbling, scary, and all too common. A cancer diagnosis is the great leveler, the kind of thing everybody fears, and all the money in the world can't prevent. In our cover story, Katie Nicol explores its chilling effect on the House of Windsor in a season when not one, but two of its four core members began treatment for cancer, and the family was forced to find a new balance between privacy and publicity. They've also had to reconcile King Charles's vision of a slimmed-down monarchy with the reality that, for an institution that trades not just on pomp and circumstance, but on personal presence, a deep bench may be necessary. As for our American queen, at least for the moment, I had read about the Harvard class being taught this spring on Taylor Swift, and then realized that the professor, in addition to being an influential poetry scholar and critic, was a former classmate of mine, also at Harvard. Stephanie Burt's piece about the experience of teaching Taylor Swift and her world at a university that had a tumultuous year, to put it mildly, reminded me that whatever else we read and see about college life, its core competency ought to be education in the most liberal sense. I'm a humanist and an idealist, granted, but I think her goal, to teach students how to think about works of art, is a noble and valuable one. Given the protest that swept across campuses this year, Harvard included, I submit both that students are more politically engaged than older generations give them credit for being, and that precisely because of our fractured culture, it's all the more important that the younger generation be able to interpret and navigate the world with a critical eye. They're the ones we need to help put it back together. Maybe some of them will do it through song. With all that in mind, I went to my 30th college reunion in June and bought a collection of Stephanie's poems titled We Are Mermaids at the Grolier Poetry Bookshop. Its slim spine belies its expansiveness. With wit and great generosity of spirit, Stephanie gives voice to a range of objects and abstractions, from airplanes to shields to marks of punctuation, within the context of larger explorations of identity. The rhymes and forms sneak up on you, potent little surprises. It had been a while since I made room for poetry, read a whole contemporary volume in one sitting, the way you'd listen to a new album or walk through an exhibition. I closed the book feeling exhilarated. I highly recommend the experience. Thank you. Now for some of the contributors to the issue. Dara Lind, Crossing Over. It's easy to present images of the U.S.-Mexico border as a spectacle, says Lind, senior fellow at the American Immigration Council and longtime immigration reporter. She was instead grateful for the opportunity to explore the fuller picture. Savannah Walsh, No Nonsense. At 25, she's a brighter version of herself, ready to embrace her newfound pop stardom, because she now knows it's only just beginning, says Walsh, who first interviewed Sabrina Carpenter shortly after her 21st birthday. Walsh, a Kansas City, Missouri native, can be found working late, because she's a writer. Emma Summerton, No Nonsense. Summerton, who photographed idiosyncratic pop star Sabrina Carpenter, has a fondness for detail and a fervor for fashion. In 2023, the Australian-born photographer became just the fifth woman to shoot the Pirelli calendar in its six-decade history. Katie Nicholl, A Royal Challenge. Nicholl is a longtime authority on the British royal family and best-selling author. Still, she says she never expected King Charles's reign to be as eventful as it has been in the first year. She lives in London with her two children. Go Nakamura, Crossing Over. Nakamura has documented new arrivals' experiences at almost every step of the U.S. border. While the border itself presents a desperate situation, it is only one part of many individual stories. Nothing compared to what they experienced during the journey from their own countries, Nakamura relayed. Stephanie Burt, Swift 101. Burt, the Donald and Catherine Locher Professor of English at Harvard University, is still reflecting on how deep Taylor Swift's fandom runs after teaching the school's first course on the songwriter and pop superstar. She will publish her next book, Super Gay Poems, released by Harvard University Press, in 2025. Damson Idris's Life in the Fast Lane by Britt Hinemuth, with photographs by Nick Riley Ventham. Opening photo shows our subject reclining on the parched earth with the mountains in the background, wearing a full suit and holding a drink. When Top Gun Maverick director Joseph Kosinski announced his next project, a Formula One movie starring Brad Pitt, everyone in Hollywood auditioned for the young lead. Last summer, a paparazzi shot of Pitt and Snowfall's Damson Idris wearing racing suits on an F1 track in the UK let the world know who got the part. "That was our first day of filming," says Idris. "I look to my left, it's Brad Pitt. I look to my right, it's Javier Bardem. I look at my hands, they're shaking, and we shoot all of this epic stuff, and all the amazing drivers are there, from Lewis Hamilton to Max Verstappen to everyone." From set in Abu Dhabi, Idris dispatches a typical day behind the wheel. "I was in the car for 45 minutes today. It sounds normal, but it's not. It's very hot out here. You're strapped in, sweating through the helmet. You lose so much weight." Juggling his rising star, Idris is keeping his eyes on the road. "I'm proud to say I know every single thing about Formula One cars. And yes, everyone here binged Formula One Drive to Survive." Born in Peckham, southeast London, Idris is the youngest of six and the only one in his family not born in Nigeria. "My mom was a trader and entrepreneur. When we arrived in London, you had to kind of hustle again and make your way up." Seeing him in a play earned the family seal of approval, even if his mom would prefer he'd do soaps. "I'll be working at the National Theatre," and she's like, "Yeah, that's great. And when are you going to end up on EastEnders?" And everyone was binging Formula One, Drive to Survive. His breakout was playing Franklin on FX's Snowfall for six seasons. "We were a show that kind of went below the radar for about three, four seasons, and then COVID hit and streaming boomed. All of a sudden, it's like, I can't go to Ralph's anymore, and the biggest musicians in the world are talking about Franklin. It's aging like wine, and I'm just thrilled that I could be a part of something like that. I think Snowfall will live forever." He brought his mom as his date to the NAACP Awards in March, where he won Outstanding Actor in a Drama Series for the series' final season. He beat his heroes Forrest Whitaker, Jesse L. Martin, and his mentor Idris Elba. During his acceptance speech, he shared that his mom flew 17 hours from Lagos, and before she boarded said, "Damson, if I come to Los Angeles, you better win." The speech went viral, making her the most famous woman in Nigeria right now. "As for Elba, he was trying to steal the trophy from me. He really is my big brother." Another viral moment was when Denzel Washington was asked about Idris on a red carpet. He replied, "I don't know who that is." Reflecting back, Idris laughs, "I had work to do." They've since met at a basketball game. "I introduced myself very timidly, and he just started tickling me. God willing, one day I will get to work with him." After meeting with Kosinski and producer Jerry Bruckheimer, he learned he got the part while traveling. "I get a call from Joe like, hey, do you want to be a Formula One driver? I was like, I'm in Turks and Caicos right now, but I can leave right now. Next thing you know, I was in London, at Rockingham, and in Silverstone training every day." Kosinski and Bruckheimer knew that Idris could act, but could he drive? It was wet that day. I'll never forget. I was like, oh my gosh, please don't crash. One, because you'll probably die, but two, more importantly, you won't get the part. Working with Kosinski was a dream come true. He is a director's director. He is the epitome of cinema, in my opinion. The feeling I felt when I walked out of Top Gun was how I felt when I was a kid and I watched E.T. or Star Wars. Those movies are just defined by one thing, entertainment. Everyone, no matter what your background, could come and watch this film. His process is amazing. As for Pitt, talk about a superstar. His humility is second to none. I don't know if people know this, but he is really good behind that car. Really good. Too good, almost. He makes me nervous how good he is. Before he was behind the wheel of a race car, Idris was picking up speed with a video game controller. I used to love playing Gran Turismo and the F1 games. Off-screen, Idris is into fashion, wearing the clothes instead of letting them wear him. I'm intrigued by my history, what I like, and how I felt living in the hood, where no one's wearing Prada, but really loving Prada. Tommy Hilfiger was the first thing I ever bought from Bicester Village. Gone Country. The country music revival continues with two star-studded music festivals by Aaron Vanderhoof, with an illustration showing a cowboy riding a bucking bronc, playing a guitar with a rattlesnake in the foreground. Over the past few years, country music has broken streaming records and minted new stars, giving this summer's festivals devoted to the genre an added allure. At Under the Big Sky in Whitefish, Montana, perennial crowd pleaser Miranda Lambert is headlining alongside bluegrass sensation Billy Strings and Americana stalwarts Turnpike Troubadours. But you can also catch the renowned Tanya Tucker and talented up-and-comers Sierra Farrell and Caitlin Butts. The Faster Horses Festival gives die-hard fans the chance to camp on the Michigan International Speedway to see radio's biggest names live. In addition to headliner sets from Yellowstone fan favorite Lainey Wilson and country's most recently unlikely star Jelly Roll, come for performances by Hardy and Ernest, two members of Morgan Wallen's Brain Trust, who throw concerts every bit as fun as their friend and co-writer. Here's what's trending. Gold Rush. When the world's greatest athletes descend on Paris, so does the spirit of the Olympic Games. Everywhere, dedication and drive abound as the quest for glory fuels the competition enough to rouse the champion in us all. In the photos, Florence Flojo Griffith Joyner at the 1988 Summer Olympics in Seoul, where she set a new world record in the 200-meter dash. And joie de vivre, Polo Ralph Lauren Team USA shirt, RF Oliver Peoples sunglasses, Maj skirt, part of a set with the dress not pictured, Louis Vuitton Paris Sport City Guide, Omega Watch, Vacation Face Mist, SPF 50, Adidas Originals by Wales Bonner Shoes, Goop Beauty Mascara, Augustinus Bader y Sofia Coppola Tinted Balm in One, Gucci Dress, Chanel Camellia Mask, Metier Bag, Still Here Capris, Hunza G Swimsuit, and The Row Shoes. Tea Time. This summer, Balmoral Castle, the Scottish estate Queen Victoria dubbed my dear paradise, and Buckingham Palace's East Wing will open to the public for intimate tours. Royal fun awaits. In the photos, Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip at Balmoral in 1972. And garden variety, Dior Men Sweater, Fendi Fan, Hermes Cocktail Trunk, Molly Goddard Sweater, Van Cleef & Arpels Watch, Janore 1735 Tea Set, Bernadette Dress, Annabella Chan Earrings, Bobby Brown Cosmetics, Chantecaille Blush in Energy, Etro Shorts, Régime de Fleur, Crushed Fruits Eau de Parfum, Glossier Invisible Shield SPF 50, and Junia Project Candle. And this from Daisy Shaw Ellis, Heat Weave, with photograph by Corey Olson showing a Loro Piana extra camera case. As the mercury rises, so too does the desire to aperitivo al fresco. This Loro Piana wicker and saddle leather bag is summer personified, gleaning inspiration from a vintage camera case and evoking afternoon picnics with a luxurious twist. Large enough to fit the essentials plus a few snacks, it's as at home on steamy city streets as it is on a Vespa ride to the shores of Lake Como. Take your pick. Thank you. Velvet Touch. With the release of his latest solo album, John Cale shows no signs of slowing down, by Mike Hogan. In the photos, John Cale, 2024, and Poptical Illusion, Cale's 18th solo studio album. There would be no Velvet Underground without John Cale, who heard an aspiring folkie named Lou Reed strum a song called Heroine in 1965 and immediately grasped its avant-garde potential. Together, the classically trained Cale and the city rat Reed revolutionized rock and roll, according to everyone except Cale, who once wrote that the attempt to see their influence everywhere struck him as fatuous. Andy Warhol took the band under his wing, paired them with the Germanic ice queen Nico, and made them part of his performance art happenings. Warhol would project his films onto the group while the superstars of the exploding plastic inevitable danced and acted out S&M scenarios. Cale says he found The Factory freakishly enjoyable. He had an affair with Edie Sedgwick, took all the drugs, and adopted Warhol's relentless work ethic. You just get your nose down and off you go. But the fun ended when Reed cut ties with Warhol and kicked Cale out of the band. Disappointed, but also a bit relieved, Cale tried producing and had a hand in such legendary albums as Patti Smith's Horses and the Stooges' eponymous debut. He also embarked on a restless career as a solo artist. As Reed morphed into the rock and roll animal, Cale refused to be pinned down. He followed up 1973's lush Paris 1919 by charging into the art rock future with Brian Eno. He married and divorced three times, including a short-lived union with the designer Betsy Johnson, and had a daughter at age 43. Her birth inspired him to get sober. By 2016, he had released 16 solo albums. Cale was touring Brazil when the pandemic hit. He had a nearly finished album in the can, but decided to rework it. Released last year to critical acclaim, Mercy features an array of ultra-cool guest artists like Wise Blood, Animal Collective, and Sylvan Esso. The album addresses our collective contemporary insanity, but also includes odes to Marilyn Monroe and his old bandmate Nico. But Mercy doesn't capture the full scope of Cale's frantic creativity during the pandemic. He began writing new songs as if it were the only thing keeping him alive, says his longtime manager and co-producer Nita Scott. I think the pandemic shifted something inside of him, and it came tumbling out. I ended up with 70 or 80 songs, Cale says. The world outside his L.A. studio offered an endless parade of surreal and disturbing material. You've got the crazies running around trying to change people's minds about what medicine is for, he says. It's remorseless. On the resulting album, Poptical Illusion, this consummate team player is, on his own, and those who know Cale from the 60s and 70s, may be surprised to hear how modern he sounds. Programmed beats skitter and loop as synths bounce and swirl. On the lead single, How We See the Light, his Welsh-inflected baritone booms over staccato chords, reminiscent of the Clash sample in MIA's Paper Planes. When I ask if he keeps up with his old factory friends, Cale says, unfortunately there aren't too many of them around. At 82, he's focused on what's next. He'd love to produce a hip-hop album with Tyler, the Creator, or Earl Sweatshirt, and he says he'll never stop making music. I can't do anything else, and I'm still learning, he says. It's a wonderful life, if you can live through it. pool party. All great hotels have top-notch service and ritzy clientele. But how many have art by Nicholas Party at the bottom of the pool by Nate Freeman? Opening photo, pool, 2023 to 2024 by Nicholas Party. Forever in context at Positano's Divine La Cernus. The term hotel art doesn't typically inspire visions of creative brilliance. Instead, calling to mind a framed seashell print at a beachside bungalow, sketches of the Eiffel Tower or Statue of Liberty, or oil paintings of horses in snow at grand ski resorts out west. But over the years, some hotels, through wealth or by happenstance, have displayed real art, art that should be hanging in a museum, or at the very least, a blue-chip gallery. In its heyday, the Ancien Hôtel Bardi in Giverny was host first to Monet, then Pissarro, Renoir, and more impressionist biggies, with many artists' work ending up on its walls. A few decades later, on the opposite side of France, the owners of La Colombe d'Or and Saint-Paul de Vence struck up a friendship with Matisse and Leger. And eventually, Picasso was gifting a painting and Calder was installing a mobile by the pool. As it turns out, even the Cubist couldn't resist bartering their work for free food and drink in the Côte d'Azur. Creative stays at these hotels. Home is where the art is, at least until checkout. The Peninsula Chicago, the Magnificent Mile Hotel, has displayed work on loan from collector Beth Rudin DeWoody and in April from the Pizzuti Collection, this Nick Cave sound suit included. Barlock, Zurich. Works from Hauser & Wirth spangle the collector's choice crash pad. A Nicholas Party landscape welcomes visitors. William Kentridge's sculptures dot the grounds. Cheval Blanc Rondelli. Bernard Arnault Maldives Gym exhibits this Vincent Burin, while Joël Andromanarisoria's pieces will dwell in the Seychelles location, set to open this fall. 21C Museum Hotel, Kansas City. Laura Lee Brown and Steve Wilson have stuffed their properties with works from their sprawling collection. Here, a Patty Carroll-designed immersive suite. West South Beach, Miami. The W houses an outpost of the art world's favorite restaurant, Mr. Chow, Tom Sachs's huge bronze Hello Kitty, and a Damien Hirst. These days, it may be harder to snag a Picasso for your vacation spot, but on the Amalfi Coast, La Cernus is keeping the tradition of contemporary patronage alive with an incredible collection of site-specific artworks made by a wild variety of artists handpicked for commissions. Co-owners Antonio and Carlos Cersale years ago decided to bring in new stuff to complement the old, building on the legacy of Antonio's father, La Cernus co-founder Franco Cersale, who had previously helped transform the former family compound into an opulent escapist fantasy. The duo managed to impress with one of their first commissions from the British artist Martin Creed, who hung one of his neon phrases, "Don't worry," in the vaulted ceiling of the hotel's main bar lounge, surrounded by arched windows with cliffside views. Looking out at the Bay of Positano, it's hard to imagine anyone does. Now, works by Stanley Whitney, Alex Israel, and Rita Ackerman live upstairs. But the latest commission might be the boldest and most ambitious yet. Cersale asked the white-hot art star Nicholas Party to design a work that can't live on a wall, but rather dwells at the bottom of the swimming pool. Pool, a classic party composition, now makes for the town's best watering hole. Does it rival the pool designed by David Hockney at the Hollywood Roosevelt, or the one Ed Ruscha did at his brother's house in Studio City? Yes. When first approached by Silke Ritson-Thomas, the London-based art advisor who helps curate the hotel's commissions, Party had never been to Le Sirenus, but that didn't matter. I said yes right away. He started sketching initial plans, intending it to be an homage to the great mosaic works in Naples' history and those found in the ruins of nearby Pompeii. And while he was aware of the Ruscha and Hockney pools, it was Hockney's famous large-scale depictions of pools in California and France he was channeling. I was very stressed about the first meeting. When you show the first drawings, it's very scary, Party said of his presentation to Sersali. But Antonio saw one, and he was like, ah, that's it. That's fantastic. Okay, this is good. Okay, let's do it. Going on for like 5 minutes. And what he saw is fairly close to what it is now. The result, a color-saturated, hyper-real homage to the clash of blue sky, cerulean sea, and jutting peaks that confronts anyone who walks out on the hotel's balcony. Party said he realized the key was to create something that looked as though it had always been there. When you do a painting, it's conceived out of context. It's in the studio in a white cube, he said, and when you do a pool in a hotel, you're aware that no one will see it out of the context. I wanted something that looked like a pool, he continued. The hotel is kind of perfect. You don't want to mess around with it too much.
Thank you.
Land of Plenty, soar cross-country with delicious novels set from sea to shining sea, where the beauty is bizarre, reality bends, and the rich are not all right, by Keziah Weir. Long Island Compromise, published by Random House. Taffy Brodesser Ackner presents The Fletchers. In the 1980s, kidnappers ransom a Long Island styrofoam baron under a false guise. Decades later, he and his family struggle with the rippling trauma. The Coin, published by Catapult. Yasmin Zaher's hypnotic debut finds a young Palestinian trust funder with money trouble teaching at a Manhattan public school, attempting to scrub her pain away with expensive skincare routines, and becoming embroiled in a Birkin bag resale scheme. Catalina, published by One World. At Harvard, titular Catalina wrestles with university rituals, a nascent flirtation, and the looming threat of U.S. immigration and customs enforcement in this funny, wrenching novel by Carla Cornejo Villavicencio. Terangeles, published by Pantheon. Little Women meets Keeping Up with the Kardashians in Purkista Kakpur's biting interpersonal dramedy. A snack titan, his wife, and their four daughters clamor for reality show stardom and then face the fallout. State of Paradise, published by FSG. In Laura Vandenberg's swampy, beguiling book, a ghostwriter in Florida receives a mysterious request from her shadowy employer. Her sister falls into a virtual world, feral cats congregate, and everywhere, everything is not as it seems. The Heart in Winter, published by Doubleday. Kevin Barry's lyrical western zeroes in on 1891 Butte, Montana, where a boozy poet and a runaway bride, hoodlums of love, are setting out through wolf country on a stolen horse to seek their fortunes. Illustrations from scenes from these books are by Lauren Tamakai. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.